Blog Talk Radio.
Graham Hancock. You're listening to Earth Ancients with Cliff Dunning.
And hello to you all. Hope you're doing well. I got a lot of emails from our last guest, Dr. Sam Osmanović, who spoke to us about the Bosnian pyramids. And, you know, there's two sides to it, really. There is the continuing discovery, the evidence of some kind of culture, some kind of ancient culture, megalithic culture. So far, the dating of the artifacts, they found one object that's 60,000 years old, carbon dated. It was a flute. There's some stone effigies. We heard from Lee Pennington, who produced a video on the Bosnian pyramids. But there's also a lot of criticism of what Dr. Sam has found. And some of the biggest critics are from the geology side. I mentioned a little bit during the interview that a lot of opposition had come from Dr. Robert Schock, who's a well-known geologist. And Schock's take on the pyramids are that they aren't really man-made, that the so-called cement blocks are actually naturally occurring sediment that solidifies. And there's examples of it around the world. And what he's claiming to be slabs of cement are actually naturally formed. So really the only way to determine what is factual and what's not is to actually go out there. And apparently you can go out there for about $1,000 and then for another $1,000, you can spend a week. It's fairly inexpensive there, and to eat and stuff. But, getting over there is the other situation. What you got to do is get over there. But I mean, I have never been over there. So when I hear these claims of false pyramid, I mean, I have to just keep reading the evidence of what is coming out. So, I mean, on the negative, on the one side, it could be a natural formed mountain that kind of looks like a pyramid, and then at some point, some civilization drilled these tunnelways. But you know, there's other things too, like this pulse that they've measured that comes out of this mountain. And I've actually seen a couple of videos on this evidence of a pulse that is magnified, and when it gets to the out and pushed out of, is pushed out of the top, it actually is a very strong measurable pulse. Now I don't know what they think this pulse is doing. And for all I know, a pulse like this could be something that happens in other natural pyramid-shaped mountains. It's just part of mystery. You know, maybe it's something that is part of, you know, the natural setting of this planet that we just don't know about because we have never studied it. But who knows? You know, I mean, I don't know. On the positive side, that like I said, they're finding evidence of a stone culture, of a megalithic culture, thousands and thousands of years ago before our written history. So it's an interesting subject, and you, the audience, were very interested in it, and we actually broke our record in terms of downloads after 24 hours. I think we hit 15,000 downloads after the first 24 hours of the program aired. So you're interested in it. So I definitely plan to have Dr. Sam on again because he's done a lot of research, not only on pyramids, but he's done research on civilizations that we really don't know a lot about. In particular, one of my favorites are the Maya. The Maya are one of those strange civilizations that show up out of nowhere with complete science and engineering and mathematics all in place. And I've seen these pyramids that they've built firsthand, and some of them are amazing. I mean, they're works of structural engineering that we just don't give enough credence to. I mean, it's like, oh, you know, the anthropologists, archaeologists say, well, yeah, they you know, they just figured out how to make pyramids, you know. But the thing is, in the work that I've done and the research I've done, there's no evidence of a chronology of pyramid building in the Mayan history. It just shows up. They show up and start building 50, 100, 200 foot high pyramids. And if you go to Tikal, all their pyramids, they have some very early complexes, but all their pyramids are very sophisticated. Some of the older ones are as well designed and engineered as the newer ones that, you know, were abandoned a couple of thousand years ago. So, I mean, there's real questions out there about pyramid building. So anyhow, getting back to Dr. Sam, we want to have him back again. If you haven't listened to last week's program, I really suggest you do listen because it does provide some real solid evidence for an unknown civilization. He is unique because he is a credentialed anthropologist who is really taking the whole subject of anthropology, archaeology, to a new level. And we're learning that these older cultures used not only natural emitting earth energies, but had an awareness of other dimensions, had an awareness of meditative states of mind, which is levels of consciousness that we don't know about, that we're discovering. Something that I've been aware of in my teachings, in my mentoring by Mayan elders, is that a lot of these buildings are alive. They're living, somewhat, they're like machines. Sam calls them machines. And when I say alive, it's like they're taking naturally emitting energy, telluric fields, geomagnetic fields, and they're transmitting them or enhancing them and pushing them out. And we don't know how they were used. In last week's interview, Sam says they were used for healing. His belief was that they were used to heal the body, heal the mind, body, and spirit. And I believe he's got something going on there. I think the more we can develop technology to scan and see what these energetic fields are all about and how they were transmuted through these pyramids, the more we'll realize that my guess is that the ancients really were focused on enhancing mind, body, and spirit in a number of different ways. So make sure you have a chance to listen to that program, Dr. Sam. We'll have Dr. Sam on again. I liked the interaction with him. I wasn't really quite sure how it was going to be, but it was good. I really thought it was really good. The artist Curtis has come up with some really, really cool t-shirt designs. As I mentioned last week, we're developing a campaign that you can help support to build and design and develop a really, really sophisticated website where I can place archives for you to download. This website, Earth Ancients website, has been in the works for a while, but the funding needs to be enhanced. I've been funding it myself, but the site has gotten to the point where to allow you, the audience, to download archival information, including digital books, digital articles, photographs, collectors' items of notes and things like that from various artists and people who allow me to promote their work. To do that, we need to build a really sophisticated website, and I need your help. And we're going to do some crowdfunding, and I'm going to be posting some photographs of the items here shortly that you can have. We'll have a whole bunch of really cool merchandise. We have sweatshirts, caps, books, audio tapes, t-shirts, whole bunch of stuff, and an opportunity to come on the show with me and interact with some of the authors are some of the possibilities that we'll include in this crowdfunding program. You know, because this is all for you. This show is designed for you, the audience, to gain knowledge, to gain interest, to grow. You know, it's fun to hear this stuff, but I want it to be more available than what I have on Facebook. Facebook is a social media tool, and it's not made to store volumes of material, and it's really lacking when it comes to archiving information in the form of digital books, graphs, and photographs. And I mean, every show, I plan to post a couple of pages of documents and photos that I just can't do on Facebook. It's just not made for that. So I hope you'll join me on the crowdfunding program that I will talk a little bit more about as the weeks come forward. Hopefully we'll get it out before the end of the year. Oh, and the other thing I want to mention is I've been kind of hinting on doing this Spotlight Wednesday. Spotlight Wednesday is going to be a second show during the week that I'm going to produce. I touched upon it last week, and what it is I get a number of new authors and researchers who are just about ready to publish, either self-publish or professionally publish their books, and they need, you know, someone to help them promote their work. And I just don't have the time or the space on a one-week show. So I want to do Spotlight Wednesdays and feature new and upcoming authors. And Jesus, I mean, I could probably do a five-day-a-week show, but I just don't have the bandwidth. I just do not have the ability to produce that many shows. So I do want to do one more show during the week and slowly grow it after that. And to do it, I need a little funding. And so that will be also part of the crowdfunding activities that you can join in. Spotlight Mondays, again, will be new and upcoming authors, researchers, and lecturers, people who speak on known and unknown civilizations. So you'll hear more about that in the coming weeks. Today's guest is Graham Hancock, and Graham Hancock really, for me, came on the scene in 1995 with this really a groundbreaking book called Fingerprints of the Gods. And what made that book so unique is that he began to question our understanding of ancient history or our current civilization. And what we're taught currently in school is that our civilization started around 3100 BC in Mesopotamia and in Egypt. And, you know, we read about the Sumerians and how they were really the first people to develop writing and mathematics and so on and so forth. Since then, there's also been discoveries in the Indus Valley area of India. And around the same time, perhaps a little later, 2500 BC, civilizations developed there. In the Aegean area, there's more development there around 2,000 years ago. And in China, 2,500, 3,000 years ago, there's the start of what they think was a civilization. But I, as a young person, questioned that theory and that understanding, because when I began traveling to Mexico, to my mind, there were civilizations that appeared to be much, much older. And what Graham did in Fingerprints of the Gods was to identify and begin questioning not only our history, but he began showing evidence of highly sophisticated civilizations in Egypt, in South America, Central America, and in some of the Asian areas. He showed some of the early structures in Cambodia and in parts of China. And in 1995, I took my first trip to Mexico and was totally astounded. I met with my friend Humboldt Smin, who is a Mayan elder, who took me to Chichen Itza, to Uxmal, to Coba. And in 95, they had just discovered Ekbalam, which is a fascinating city, small city in northern Yucatan Peninsula of Mexico. And for any of you that do vacation that live in the United States, or for that matter, if you live anywhere in the world, if you're interested in ancient cultures, Chichen Itza is a fabulous place to check out. It has the pyramid, the El Castillo, the castle pyramid. Unfortunately, you can't walk on it anymore, but you can at least look at it and look at the amazing sculpture and engineering. You can look at a number of other structures. There's different levels. There's one area that has very, very, very old sculptures and buildings that they believe is much older than a couple thousand years old. It's really, actually, if you're interested in any of these places, you need to actually get on a plane and go. Graham Hancock, it was a turning point, because he puts it all into context and gives us a reference and makes us think about what our history has become, which is a point of view from academics who don't question the past. I'm going to go ahead and play this interview. I'll come back at the end and we'll talk a little bit about what's happening next week. So I have the great pleasure today to have with me the celebrated author, Graham Hancock, who many of you know from Fingerprints of the Gods. This new book that we're going to talk about today is Magician of the Gods, which was recently released in the States. And I just got my copy a few days ago, and typical of Graham, it's 400 plus pages, beautifully illustrated or with photographs taken by, I guess, his wife. And anyhow, Graham, thank you for joining us and welcome to the program.
Well, that's my pleasure, Cliff. Thanks for having me on the show.
Great. Hey, is Magicians of the Gods, does it actually pick up where Fingerprints left off, or is it all a different focus? What would you say?
No, it's not a different focus, but it's a book that became necessary for me to write because a huge amount of new evidence that touches directly on the themes that I explored in Fingerprints of the Gods has emerged in the past 20 years. And you see, when I published Fingerprints of the Gods in 1995, the reaction of the archaeological community and of their friends in the media was very hostile indeed. Who is this outsider daring to suggest that we've got the story of the origins of civilization wrong? And they used arguments from authority to dismiss the notion that there could have been a lost civilization and that there could have been, that there could have been a giant global cataclysm somewhere in the window between 12,000 and 13,000 years ago. That's what I argued in Fingerprints of the Gods. And I realized when I wrote that book that I was sticking my neck out. But what's happened since then has massively supported the essential case for a lost civilization that I made in Fingerprints of the Gods. For example, we now have, which we did not have in 1995, compelling scientific evidence of the nature of the cataclysm that I had proposed in Fingerprints of the Gods. That cataclysm falling between 13,000 and 12,000 years ago, I looked into all kinds of possibilities of what might have caused it, but there was no firm science. So in a sense, the scientific community was right to take me for task, to task for that. But what's happened since then, particularly since 2007, and up till now, mainly confined to the rarefied atmosphere of scientific journals, has been the evidence that the Earth was struck by several fragments of a large comet 12,800 years ago, and that the primary impacts were on what was then the North American ice cap. This was the Ice Age, and North America was, north of roughly Minneapolis, was covered in ice about 2 miles deep at that point. And there were colossal impacts on the ice cap, which resulted in a flood of icy water pouring into the Atlantic Ocean, stopping the Gulf Stream dead and plunging the Earth into a 1,200-year period of cataclysmic cold, accompanied by massive, very wide-scale animal extinctions, particularly the megafauna like the woolly mammoths and the rhinos and so on and so forth. And then right. 1,200 years later, there was another shocking event, and the Earth's temperature shot up equally dramatically. It had plunged down 12,800 years ago, and it shot up again 11,600 years ago. Both events were accompanied by global flooding. The second event appears to have been caused by further impacts from fragments of the same comet, this time falling into ocean and throwing up a huge flood of water vapor into the upper atmosphere, shrouding the planet, creating a greenhouse effect, and thus explaining the sudden warming that occurred at that time. And by the way, that warning was of an order magnitudes greater than anything that's being talked about global warming today. This was a giant climatic disaster. It's what's actually called an extinction level event. The last time that something on this scale happened was 65 million years ago when the dinosaurs were destroyed. We all know that's a fact. The new evidence that something like that happened right in the foundations of history is one of the main reasons, just 12,800 years ago, is one of the main reasons why I've written this book. It completely vindicates the case made in Fingerprints of the Gods. And of course, it's accompanied by the discovery of lots of archaeological sites that don't fit the picture of history that's been painted by mainstream archaeologists.
That's the beauty of your work, is that you highlight this ancient past civilizations with the ruins of these unknown civilizations. You just mentioned something quite interesting. Randall Carlson is highlighted in your book, and his work is fascinating, quite fascinating.
He's a great man, a fascinating researcher.
Yes.
Really walks the walk. He has got a unique insight into this cataclysm, as a matter of fact. And I cite his work extensively, and Randall and I made a field trip together across North America, driving from Portland, Oregon, to Minneapolis, Minnesota, to look at the effects of the flooding on the ground south of the ice cap, because the water didn't only go into the Atlantic Ocean and stop the Gulf Stream, it also flowed south in cataclysmic quantities across particularly the Pacific Northwest, where we have the channeled scablands, but actually all the way across North America, as far east as the Finger Lakes of New York State.
Does he believe that this impact was a terminating event globally?
Clarify what you mean by a terminating event globally.
I always think of Velikovsky's belief that the Earth was hit by an asteroid, and basically that was the beginning of the Ice Age, and so on and so forth. But Randall, in his work, shows evidence in Washington State of flooding and great damage. And is it his belief that there's that this impact caused the death of not only the woolly mammoth and other animals, but of whatever civilizations were on the planet at that time?
Yeah, Randall and I share that view, and that is the view that that I am supporting with masses of evidence in Magicians of the Gods, that this was an impact that changed the world. Look, it's important to be clear. Excuse me, I've got a bit of a cough. It's important to be clear that these extinction-level events, in other words, cataclysms that are accompanied by massive levels of extinctions of species, are game changers. And to put that into context, everybody knows about the dinosaurs, okay? The dinosaurs were made extinct 65 million years ago, and we now know why they were made extinct. The Earth was hit by a six-mile-wide object. May have been an asteroid, may have been a comet. They're not certain about that, but the crater has been found. It's the Chicxulub crater in the Gulf of Mexico, edging into the Yucatan. The evidence for the impact is all over the world in a particular layer of soil that they call the Cretaceous Tertiary Boundary, which is filled with impact proxies. This includes melt glass, nanodiamonds, carbon spherules, iridium, and so on, the sure signatures of a cosmic impact. So this huge space rock comes winging in. They're coming in at 70,000 miles an hour. These things are packing energy vastly larger than the entire accumulated arsenal, nuclear arsenal of the Earth, being set off at once, to put them in some kind of perspective. And it hits the Earth, and it creates a global cataclysm, global wildfires, a complete change. The dinosaurs do not survive it. Meanwhile, if they survive it, they devolve. Some people have argued that chickens are the descendants of dinosaurs. So this is an event big enough to turn dinosaurs into chickens, okay? At the same time, a tiny little mammal, which looks a bit like a shrew, which has been skulking around in the primeval forests of 65 million years ago and going nowhere, well, suddenly the way is opened for that mammal to begin the process of evolution. And that mammal is our 65 million year old grandmother. In other words, human beings would not be here today if that event had not occurred that made the dinosaurs extinct, wiped the slate clean, terminated that epoch, and allowed the beginning of a new one. These are world-changing events, and we now know that we had an event on a similar scale to the event that caused the extinction of the dinosaurs just very recently in the foundations of history between 12,800 and 11,600 years ago. And just like the extinction of the dinosaurs, that event, which is called the Younger Dryas impact, that event was world-changing. It ended a former regime of the world. It ended a former civilization, and it opened the way to the new age in which we live. And we imagine that our story The story that we tell ourselves about civilization is the beginning of the story of civilization. In fact, it's not. It's the restarting of civilization after a global cataclysm.
Why do you think that there is so much opposition from the scientific orthodoxy on some of your claims of a previous high civilization? Is it because it's too much for them to consider and having to turn back the hands of time and reassess your discoveries, or is it just that it's more convenient to cover their eyes?
No, I think it's actually quite a normal process in science. The studies have even been done about this. Scientists are aware of it. The Structure of Scientific Revolutions by Thomas Kuhn, I think it was, documents this thoroughly, that when a body of science, when a body of science is heavily invested in a particular view, in a particular idea about how things happened, the individuals who are invested in that view, it becomes of existential importance to them. If the view is challenged, that is taken psychologically as a direct attack on the individual himself or herself. And this then kicks in all kinds of territorial mechanisms to protect and defend the established territory. Now, I mean, an example of this not so long ago, actually, was the switch from the Earth-centered view of the universe to the heliocentric view of the universe. In other words, the Ptolemaic view, which held for a very long period of time, was that the Earth was at the center of everything and that the Sun went around the Earth. And this view was still being held in the Middle Ages and through into the 15th and 16th centuries when new science was emerging that contradicted that view. And at that time, the holders of the old view that the Earth was the center of everything, that the Earth did not move, that everything revolved around the Earth, they held that view so strongly that they were actually prepared to kill you if you expressed an opposite point of view. You know, Galileo expressed that view, and he was shown the instruments of his torture before he recanted and said, okay, the Earth doesn't move. Copernicus hid his knowledge that the Earth went around the Sun and did not allow it to be published until after his death because he was afraid that he would be killed. Giordano Bruno was burnt agonizingly and slowly at the stake in 1601 for holding the view that the Earth orbits around the Sun. But all these individuals were absolutely right. The Earth does orbit around the Sun. And eventually, the new science prevailed. The evidence that the Earth is in orbit around the Sun, rather than the other way around, became so overwhelming that the existing paradigm could not hold. And after hundreds of years, it finally fell and collapsed and thus opened the way to a new view of the universe. And I think that's what's happening with history now. We've had a century, more than a century, of historians and archaeologists who are invested deeply in a particular view about the origins of civilization. And the evidence of the cataclysm 12,800 years ago and of archaeological sites that don't fit the picture is already overwhelmingly strong. But there's huge resistance to it because that resistance involves the individuals who are invested in the old paradigm, effectively throwing up their hands and saying, well, we were wrong about everything. And that's difficult for any human being to do. So this appears to be a normal process in science, and archaeology is no exception.
So you're not dismayed at the lack of acceptance. And I guess as an example, before we started, we were talking about Dr. Danny Hillman in Java, Indonesia, who's at this Gunung Penang pyramid that we've had him on the show before. I think that discovery changes everything.
It does. It does change. It does change everything.
Yeah. I mean, he has followed orthodox procedures. He's carbon dated the site. I think the last time they did a study was 20,000 years or older. How
That's
important
right.
is that structure, would you say, in the mix?
I would say Gunung Padang, which I devote several chapters to in the book, is an extremely important structure. But what adds to its importance is that it's not alone. There's another structure equally anomalous in Turkey called Göbekli Tepe, which we'll no doubt get onto. Gunung Padang is intriguing. There was a known archaeological site on top of what was thought to be a natural hill. And that known archaeological site is megalithic in nature, and it's made of a material called columnar basalt, which does form naturally, but here has been redeployed as construction blocks. And there's a series of terraces in plain view on the top of what was thought to be a natural hill. And archaeologists have been aware of this megalithic site since the early 20th century, and they had done very little work on it, but roughly were of the opinion that it dated back about 2,500 years, which doesn't change anything at all. Mm-hmm. Danny Hillman is Indonesia's leading geological expert in megathrust earthquakes. He's a highly qualified Caltech-trained geologist, and he brought his geological eye to Gunung Padang. He visited the site one day just out of interest, and it occurred to him that these terraces didn't really look like they were standing on a natural hill. They looked like they were standing on a man-made mound about 300 feet high, that there was something very structural about this mound. And in fact, further down out the sides of the mounds, you could see more bits of columnar basalt sticking out. So he decided to deploy his geological skills, and he assembled a team of geologists to do a thorough survey of this supposed natural hill. And they had the equipment. They had the ground-penetrating radar. They had the seismic tomography. They had the electrical resistivity. They ran lines all over the sides of this mound. And they were able to look inside it, to scan its interior. And lo and behold, they discovered that it was entirely a man-made mound. And that it had been built up over a very long period of time by successive generations, and that the oldest, deeper layers of it indeed go back 20,000 years plus into the past, deep into the last ice age, when our ancestors are supposed to have been nothing more than simple, nomadic hunter-gatherers, quite incapable of creating structures on this scale. More than that, their remote sensing revealed the existence of three regular chambers inside the Gunung Padang mound. These are the chambers that we really need to get into and find out exactly what's going on there. Now, because this work has been done by geologists, archaeologists in Indonesia have objected to it, and Danny and his team have again and again had obstacles thrown in their way. You know, archaeologists sometimes behave the typical dog in the manger behavior. They don't want anybody else to go to this place, even though they themselves are not interested in it.
Exactly.
You know, this is very, 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 very silly behavior. And so Danny faced a lot of obstacles. And again, the work that he and his team were doing were stopped. Now, he's quite a canny operator, Danny. And he went right up to the top. He went to the president of Indonesia. And he brought the president of Indonesia to the site in December 2013, shortly after my first visit there. And the president of Indonesia, President Yudhoyono at that time, after being shown the evidence that Danny and his team had assembled, was just stunned that archaeologists were preventing excavation of the site. And he made an executive order that Danny and his team would be allowed to excavate and that they should go ahead. And he even provided them with facilities and a budget to do so. It took quite a while to get ready for the next level of the investigation. They didn't start until August 2014. But by October 2014, the beginning of October 2014, they were already drilling down to one of those chambers. And that's when, unfortunately, the presidency of Indonesia changed. And on the 10th of October 2014, President Widodo took over. The archaeologists who were objecting to the work and who wanted the budget given to the work, they wanted that budget for themselves, they appealed to the new president, and they had him stop the excavations yet again. And the excavations have been largely stalled for more than a year since then. I know that Danny will get the excavation started again. He's very optimistic that it'll be soon. But these are the kind of obstacles, that the real direct obstacles that are faced when you try to do the work that might completely change our understanding of the origins of civilization.
To me, it seems like there's something that's really missing here. Here is a scientist who has the carbon dating facts, And yet we don't hear about it in main radio, TV, or news, other than a few light mentions. This is a major breakthrough. This is a major discovery.
It's a major breakthrough. It's a major breakthrough, and the reasons we don't hear about it in mainstream media. I can't blame the mainstream journalists for this. Most of them are completely ignorant about the issues of archaeology and civilization. Mm-hmm. So if they want an opinion, if they want to check whether something is worth them looking into or not, they'll call up the archaeologist, their archaeologist contact, and they'll say, what do you think of this? And because that archaeologist contact is invested in the existing system of ideas about the past, he'll say, oh, that's rubbish. And the journalist will then drop the story. I've seen this happen again and again and again. It's very few journalists that are prepared to overwrite that and actually do some serious investigation for themselves. And that's why this story is hardly being reported in the mainstream media.
Mm-hmm. But, I mean, there's more than just the digging that Dr. Hillman's doing. They've tested this pyramid, and they have detected various emanations coming out of it. We don't know if there's any kind of machinery or it's on top of a geomagnetic field that's pushing telluric energy up and through the pyramid, which a number of Mayan pyramids have shown to have in effect. I mean, it's a major, major discovery, I think.
And it's a major discovery. It can change everything. And the plain fact is, what is needed is a thorough, detailed excavation. And I would say I'm optimistic, Danny's optimistic, within the next few months we'll see that restarted. This is too important to be set aside by the bad temper and selfishness of a few archaeologists. It really is. It's a very, very important thing. And we have to consider also, you know, the story of Indonesia itself. This is also part of it. It's not just random that it's in Indonesia. Indonesia today, of course, is a country made up of islands, some very large islands, such as Sulawesi or Sumatra or Java, some very small islands like Flores, for example, or Komodo. Now, this was not the case during the Ice Age. During the Ice Age, sea level was 400 feet lower than it is today. All those huge ice sheets that sat on top of North America and Northern Europe, when they melted, the water went into the ocean, and the ocean rose by 400 feet. The primary rise in the oceans was exactly in the period that I've indicated, between 12,800 and 11,600 years ago. And that rising sea level, very rapid, global flooding on a humongous scale, that rising sea level changed Indonesia utterly. At that time, there wasn't the Malaysian Peninsula and then the Indonesian islands. There was a huge continent-sized landmass that, because sea level was 400 feet lower, and archaeologists call not archaeologists, geologists refer to this landmass as Sunda Land or the Sunda Shelf. This is geologically the area. So sea levels rise very rapidly, and a continent-sized landmass goes under the water, leaving only remnant islands and a peninsula. And it's on the highland of one of these remnant islands that the site of Gunung Padang stands. Now, when we look at former Indonesia, the Sunda Shelf, when it was above water, it was an ideal place for a civilization to grow and develop. It was incredibly fertile, and it was very well watered. There were at least three major river systems running through it. We know those rivers were there because their courses can still be traced on the bottom of the sea, but they were covered up by the rising sea levels. So a land that could have been an ideal home for a civilization is destroyed in the cataclysmic flooding at the end of the Ice Age. And what Gunung Padang looks like, dare I say it, is a kind of hall of records, a place of safety, where the knowledge and the wisdom of that civilization, their archives even, could be hidden away and concealed and kept safe. And that's why it's interesting to consider what the actual name Gunung Padang means. In the Indonesian language, which most people think it's spoken in, it doesn't seem to mean very much. It means mountain field, But if you go into the Sundanese language, which is the language that's actually spoken around Gunung Padang, you find that what it means is mountain of light or mountain of enlightenment. And there are indeed traditions attaching to it of remote antiquity and of great wisdom being associated with it. So, you know, these are all indications that we're dealing with something very important that's been handed down to us like a time capsule from a time when the world was very different by a civilization that no longer exists. And it's crazy that we're not excavating it and figuring out what it's all about.
One of the things that I find interesting is that you in both of your books, Fingerprints of the Gods and this new book, I haven't really read in depth, but I have kind of skimmed it. I'm looking forward to a good read. You don't provide a understanding of what you believe would be the level of sophistication of this civilization that predates us. But given the discoveries of a number of people in some of these ruins, it's obvious that they had tremendous amount of technical ability and a science.
Well, I actually do go into this in the book, and I do go into it in my earlier books to some extent. Look, I don't want to. I'm dealing with an area that's extremely controversial, and I feel there's a battle to be won here. The existing model of history is wrong. It's misleading us. We're being misled by a false idea of our past. And it's and I think it's important that the new information gets through and that people understand it. So I avoid as far as possible completely groundless speculation on subjects for which I have no evidence. A lot of people do that in books. I don't do that. I want to present solid material, and so I try as far as possible to stick to that solid material. But there's a number of things that we can say for sure. From the traces that have come down, we're looking at a civilization that did have advanced scientific knowledge. It was very advanced in the fields of astronomy and navigation, for example. There are maps of the world that have come down from this time, copied and recopied and recopied again from older source maps now lost. Maps that have come down that show the world as it looked during the last ice age, incredibly accurate renditions of how the world actually looked at that time, which alone should tell us that somebody was exploring the earth and mapping it in that period. But then we discover that these maps actually incorporate extremely accurate relative longitudes. And longitude is something that our civilization was only started to be able to do in the late 18th century and the beginning of the 19th century. Before that, there was no knowledge of it whatsoever, with the result that shipping was constantly sailing into unsuspected coastlines because they thought they were, you know, hundreds of miles east or west of the place where they actually were. The technology to do accurate longitudes only came in at the end of the 18th century, beginning of the 19th. So in that alone, in the maps, we're looking at a civilization that was competent to navigate and explore the world and to map it with a very high level of accuracy at a level that our civilization didn't reach until the beginning of the 19th century. But this was happening way back, more than 12 to 20,000 years ago, and that cannot be explained by the existing model of history. Another issue is the huge megaliths that are moved around, just gigantic blocks of stone. In the case of Baalbek in the Lebanon, which is another site that I visited while researching this book, there are three blocks of stone that each weigh 900 tons. Each of them is a 900-ton block. And if you consider that the average family car, you know, weighs a bit over a ton, you're looking at the weight of 700 or 800 family-sized cars in each one of those blocks. And they're raised up 30 feet above the ground, and they're joined together so precisely that you can't even slip a piece of paper into the joint between them. So there's high precision and evidence of lifting ability, of the ability to move just humongous blocks of stone. Now, I'm not saying that we couldn't do that today, but it would be very, very difficult to do it. The setting up of a crane that can shift a block of the order of 900 of tons, such a crane, it takes about 6 weeks to set it into position. And that's a fixed lift. That's not a mobile lift where you're moving it from one place to another, as happened here. And this happens all around the world. It happens in ancient Egypt, in the megalithic temples around the Sphinx. It happens up in the Andes at Sacsayhuaman and Cusco. Just evidence of stunning feats of manipulation of matter. And my sense is that we're dealing with an ancient civilization that had a way of dealing with matter that is different from our own. We've gone down the route of mechanical advantage. We think that everybody did things that way. We're particularly good at it ourselves. But it's clear to me that there were other ways of manipulating matter. A lot of ancient traditions suggest that sound was used, that there was some kind of science of sound that could be used to alter the vibrational frequency of large and heavy materials and make them lighter and easier to move. Accounts of priests, for example, singing gigantic blocks of stone into place. And evidence also, this is particularly obvious up in the Andes, of the softening of stone, that some technique was deployed to make stone soft so that it could be molded almost like putty. So you get these huge three-dimensional jigsaw puzzles in the walls of Sacsayhuaman, blocks weighing up to 350 tons, jointed together with other blocks along multiple angles with incredibly high precision. The suggestion there is that a technique was used that softened the stone and made it possible to mold it almost like putty before it set hard again. So I think there's lots of hints, actually, of a higher technology. And something else we need to consider this may sound, it perhaps is speculative, and I don't go into it too much, but the issue of psychic powers. You know, our culture is all about mechanical advantage, and we have let go certain faculties of the human mind, which occasionally emerge. I think they're latent in all of us, but they're not used by our society. I think a former civilization, the former civilization that I'm writing about, was highly advanced in that area, and telekinesis was a real thing to them. That would be my suggestion.
It's funny you mentioned Baalbek, Lebanon, because it's a fascination of mine, those megaliths. Mm-hmm. And I did happen to look at that chapter, and it's a wonderful chapter that you highlight there, but it's funny because the archaeologists and the other scientists who you connect with believe it's those megaliths are the work of Romans. But are there any examples anyplace else in Europe of Romans using blocks that are 800 tons or bigger?
Nowhere else that they built on that scale. It's totally it's totally unique.
Yeah, the temple.
I'm quite certain it's not
structure. Yeah.
It's a totally unique structure. It's a very weird structure, and I'm quite certain that the Romans were not involved in all of it. Again, one can understand the confusion of the archaeologists, because there is a Roman site there, and that's the temple of Jupiter. No dispute that that's Roman. It's one of the largest Roman temples ever built in the ancient world. And oddly, there are no records of its construction, but you can be quite sure there's Roman writing all over it. You can be quite sure that the Temple of Jupiter and the associated Temple of Bacchus and Temple of Venus are a Roman temple complex. The issue is that they were built on top of a much older site. And a particular element of that site is where these big blocks are found. There is effectively a U-shaped megalithic wall which runs along the north side of the Roman Temple of Jupiter, then along the west side, and then along the south side. And at no point does it actually touch the Temple of Jupiter. It's completely separate from the Temple of Jupiter, but it surrounds it. It almost embraces it. And my argument and the evidence I present is that that megalithic wall is vastly, vastly more ancient than the Roman Temple of Jupiter, and that indeed the Roman Temple may have been situated there precisely because of the pre-existence of that wall. And it's in that very anomalous and puzzling wall that these three giant blocks of the Trilithon are found. And they're associated with further blocks which are still in the quarry at Baalbek. And the blocks in the quarry are even bigger. They've been completely cut and shaped, and in one case actually completely separated from the bedrock. However, they've remained in the quarry. And one of them weighs 1,000 tons. Another one is calculated to weigh 1,250 tons. And a third one only discovered in June last year, is calculated to weigh 1,460 tons. Now, it's interesting it was only discovered in June last year. The German Archaeological Institute has been excavating Baalbek for the best part of a century. And yet, this massive block of stone, 1,460-ton block of stone, was only discovered last June. And the reason it was only discovered last June was because it was completely covered by sediment. The suggestion I make is that let me tell you the archaeological story. They say that the Romans did make the U-shaped wall, and they say, therefore, that the Romans could move 900-ton blocks. But after cutting out and quarrying those huge blocks in the quarry, which weigh a bit more, they discovered they couldn't move them, so they just abandoned them and left them in the quarry. To me, this sounds like very un-Roman behavior. The Romans, if that scenario is correct, and the Romans did cut the blocks in the quarry and did find they couldn't move them, they wouldn't just have left them there. They would have sliced them up like loaves of bread and used the smaller blocks thus produced in the construction of their temple. The fact that they didn't touch them at all, that they just left them sitting there, suggests to me very strongly that they didn't know they were there, that the whole place was covered with sediment at that time and only uncovered much later on. If the Romans had known those blocks were there, even if they couldn't move them, they would certainly have cut them up into smaller blocks.
Yeah.
So I think there's a strong case that Baalbek is, the elements of Baalbek are much, much older. And in, you know, I go into that in depth in the book. There's a lot of other reasons beyond the reasons I've given you here. But it's an intriguing site and definitely worthy of a second look. And I had a good dialogue with the archaeologists there. They were willing to communicate with me. And, you know, we had a debate about it. And I give both sides of the case.
There's a picture of you standing on one huge megalith at Baalbek, and I can't think of the name of it. It's
that's called the Stone of the Pregnant Woman.
The Stone of the Pregnant Woman.
That's what it's locally known as after some legend. What it was originally known as, who knows?
But it's curious because if you look at it from any angle above, it has a level of precision cutting that's just unparalleled. I just cannot believe it. And it's funny that we don't have a technology to scan this block to see what the instrument was used in cutting it, because it seems like the level of perfection is pretty high on that piece. It doesn't look like it's chiseled in any way, but I could be wrong.
You're right. It's very, very high. It's beautifully cut, as is the case with the blocks embedded in the western end of that U-shaped wall. I mean, this is beautiful work on a scale of acres. This is giant stuff. Indeed, there are legends. You know, the local population seeing those blocks in the wall and seeing the blocks in the quarry elaborated legends about how they could only have been moved by giants. I don't think physical giants were involved, but giant intellects, yes. Giant scientific abilities, yes. That's what it manifests.
That's fascinating. Let's go to Turkey, and we have to talk about Göbekli Tepe. This is a game changer, and you've spent quite a bit of the book talking about it. You actually spoke with who recently picked Klaus Schmidt, who was the lead archaeologist.
Yes.
Why is it important? Why is this discovery so important in the scheme of things regarding history?
Yes. Well, first of all, about Klaus Schmidt, Professor Klaus Schmidt was the head of the German Archaeological Institute's excavations at Göbekli Tepe in Turkey, because the German Archaeological Institute runs the excavations in Baalbek in the Lebanon and also at Göbekli Tepe in Turkey.
Oh, right. Interesting.
And normally, when I turn up on an archaeological site, archaeologists run a mile. You know, it's as though a vampire has appeared, and they dare not even speak with me. But Klaus Schmidt was quite different. I've got great respect for him. He knew who I was. He welcomed me to the site. He said, "Look, I know you have a different view on this, but let me take you around and I'll show you what I know." And he was very open. He spent 3 days with me at the site, showing me around in detail, answering all my questions, giving me and my wife Santa, who's a photographer, complete access to the site to work on it. It was we really had great access to it thanks to Klaus. And I'm sad to report that Klaus passed away in 2014. He died in the summer of 2014 of a heart attack. So I'm very glad I had the opportunity to meet him on the site in 2013. So here's what happened. Back in the very early 1950s, a group of American archaeologists were looking for substantial Stone Age remains in that region of Turkey. And they came to Göbekli Tepe. And by the way, the words Göbekli Tepe mean pot-bellied hill in the Turkish language. They came to that area and they did see some flints, which are typical Stone Age material, lying on the ground. They were interested in that. And then they saw some very beautifully cut tops of pillars sticking out of the ground. And because of their preconceptions, they immediately decided that this therefore could not be a site dating back to the period they were interested in. This had to be something quite recent because of the quality of the workmanship. In fact, they decided that it must be a Byzantine cemetery, not more than 1,000 years old, and therefore of no interest to them. So with those preconceptions, they walked away and left the site alone. And it wasn't until the second half of the 1990s that Klaus Schmidt came to the site, and their loss was his gain, because he was equipped with more information on other recent excavations in Turkey, which suggested that fine workmanship was actually getting older and older and older, and he was willing to take a look. And he began to excavate Göbekli Tepe, and in the process, as the years went by, he revealed the largest megalithic site that has ever been created anywhere on Earth. Actually, vast amount of it is still under the ground. More than 50 times as much as has already been excavated is still under the ground, still deeply buried. They know that just because, the same as they did at Gunung Padang, they've been over it with ground-penetrating radar, and that has revealed the presence of hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of giant megalithic pillars still lying under the ground that haven't been excavated. The area that has been excavated is about the same size as Stonehenge, and now we know more than 50 times as much is still under the ground. So this is a site 50 times larger than Stonehenge, and here's the kicker, it's 7,000 years older than Stonehenge. That's what changes everything. Because Stonehenge, a known megalithic site, archaeology has a story about that. It has a story about how our ancestors started to make megalithic sites. It wasn't something archaeology likes to claim that they could do when they were hunter-gatherers. Agricultural civilizations had to have emerged with settled communities and the opportunity for specialists who weren't required to go out and hunt and gather all day long, but who could specialize skills in stone masonry and astronomy and so on, and they would be deployed to create a site like this. The problem with Göbekli Tepe is it's 11,600 years old, at a time when the inhabitants of the area are supposed to have been entirely hunter-gatherers with no specialists. And so it just pops up out of nowhere with no background and no explanation. And even more puzzling, the oldest stuff at Göbekli Tepe is the best. There's a clear evidence of decline in the skills deployed at Göbekli Tepe over the 1,200 years that the site existed. And then, so the site ran from 11,600 years ago down to 10,400 years ago. And then, mysteriously, it was deliberately buried. That's systematically and deliberately buried. That pot-bellied hill that gives the site its name is entirely an artificial construct. The teams of people, hundreds and hundreds of them, must have been deployed effectively with buckets filled with soil and with rubble, stone rubble, which they poured into the enclosures containing the standing stone pillars, completely covering them up, continued the process, built it up over it, and covered the whole thing with this, now we know, completely artificial hill, which then, for the next 10,400 years, was never touched by human hand again. It
what
lay
is the
there
explanation
hidden.
Explanation for that, Graham. Let me just interrupt you. What is the explanation for filling this these chambers with rocks. Why would they do that? What do they think the reason would be?
Well, there's very little speculation on what the reason would be by archaeologists. I have given the matter some thought, and I believe that Göbekli Tepe is a classic time capsule. We do that kind of thing today in our society. If we want to preserve something for the future, we deliberately bury it and hide it away. And I think that's what happened with Göbekli Tepe. I think it is a message to the future. And it's very uncanny that it's been discovered in our time. It's very strange. There are elements of the astronomy of Göbekli Tepe that appear to envisage the skies of our time, not the skies of 11,600 years ago. And this is a most curious situation about Göbekli Tepe. Something else is that 11,600 years ago was precisely that second spike of the Younger Dryas cataclysm. The first event was 12,800 years ago. The second one was 11,600 years ago. It was accompanied by dramatic global sea level rise. And that's exactly the moment that Göbekli Tepe suddenly pops up out of nowhere with a supposedly hunter-gatherer population, completely equipped with all the skills and all the organizational abilities to create the largest megalithic site in the world in an area where there's no water. So they would have had to have brought water in to nourish and feed their workforce. It's really an astonishing feat of organization. And another point, Cliff, is that 11,600 years ago is the date that Plato gives us for the submergence of the lost civil, the destruction and submergence of the lost civilization of Atlantis. And that, I think, can't be ignored either. And I go into this in the book. Plato tells us very clearly that Atlantis, which was a great civilization based upon an island, was destroyed in a global cataclysm of fire and flood 9,000 years before the time of the Greek lawmaker Solon. And the Greek lawmaker Solon lived in 600 BC. So 9,000 years before the time of Solon is 9,600 BC, which is 11,600 years ago, which is the date for the founding of Göbekli Tepe. In short, I don't think that we see a marvelously inspired group of hunter-gatherers waking up one morning fully equipped with all the skills and abilities to create the world's largest and most complex megalithic site. I think what we see is a transfer of technology from the survivors of a lost civilization wiped out in that cataclysm of 11,600 years ago. There were survivors, some of them settled in Göbekli Tepe and transferred their skills to the local inhabitants. And that's why we see agriculture cropping up there at exactly the same time. Previously, they'd been hunter-gatherers. Now, as Göbekli Tepe is set in motion as a kind of center of innovation, agriculture spreads like wildfire around that same region of Turkey.
Mm-hmm. So is it your feeling that Göbekli Tepe was a kind of a university of learning?
Yes.
I
think it was the work of the survivors of a lost civilization who recruited the local hunter-gatherers and initiated them into their system of knowledge, equipping them to create this gigantic site and at the same time teaching them how to do agriculture. And in fact, Klaus Schmidt did not, at least on the notion of Göbekli, he didn't want to go to the notion of the survivors of a lost civilization, but on the notion of Göbekli Tepe as a center of innovation, Klaus Schmidt absolutely supported that something wonderful happened here, something really extraordinary happened that changed the game completely, and truly is the beginning of our current age of the Earth. It was the beginnings of the story of civilization as we tell it. And what's clear now is that, as I said before, that it wasn't a beginning, it was a remaking of civilization.
So possibly Göbekli Tepe was a place to kickstart the new civilization with the surviving high culture individuals being the ones who are pretty much putting that place in action, is what you're saying.
Yeah, that's exactly my case. But it wasn't alone. That there were many other places around the world where survivors of the lost civilization settled. And one of them, most distinctly and obviously, is ancient Egypt. And this brings us, of course, to the great Sphinx of ancient Egypt, around which an atmosphere of mystery has clung for thousands of years. But the Egyptological case that the great Sphinx was made in 2500 BC, 4,500 years ago, that case is incredibly flimsy. It rests literally on nothing, absolutely nothing at all. It's like a fairy tale. And I do deconstruct the Egyptological case for the dating of the Sphinx in Magicians of the Gods. Now, we've known since 1992, when geology professor Robert Schock of Boston University was brought to the site by rogue Egyptologist John Anthony West, we've known since 1992 that the Great Sphinx and the trench that surrounds it and the megalithic temples in front of it bear the unmistakable marks of exposure to a very long period of heavy rainfall. It's called precipitation-induced weathering. And the science of ancient climates is very well advanced, and we know that for the last 5,000 years, the Giza Plateau in Egypt has been as dry and as arid as it is today. It gets very, very, very little rain, and certainly never enough rain in the last 5,000 years to account for the deep precipitation-induced weathering that we see on the Sphinx. So this tells us that the Sphinx must be older than 4,000 or 5,000 years. And indeed, you have to go back to that same cataclysmic episode between 12,800 and 11,600 years ago to get that rain out following the comet impacts that would have been capable of creating the erosion that we see on the Sphinx. In other words, the argument has been present for since 1992 that the Great Sphinx may be 12,000 plus years old. Now, that argument was hotly disputed by Egyptologists at the time. And they thought it was their killer argument. You know, they said that, no, the Great Sphinx cannot possibly be in the range of 12,000 years old, because if there were some culture in the world capable of creating something like the Great Sphinx 12,000 years ago, why, we would find other examples of their workmanship, and we don't find any other site in the world that's even approaching 12,000 years old. Well, now we do. We have since then Göbekli Tepe has been discovered, and we know for sure that it is 11,600 years old, very close to 12,000 years old, and Gunung Padang has been discovered with the compelling evidence that it may go back 20,000 years. So suddenly the Great Sphinx doesn't stand alone as an isolated example of the work of a high culture 12,000 years ago. It fits into a pattern that we're seeing all around the world, and this pattern is compelling, and I believe it is going to require archaeologists to rethink their whole story of the origins of civilization.
Definitely. And the beauty of that was that Schock was able to show the weathering of the limestone in that area, which was a shock to everybody. This was the multidisciplinary approach that really, I think, opened the door to looking at ancient cultures in Egypt. Another individual who I know you're familiar with, who doesn't get talked a lot about right now, is recently the engineer Chris Dunn, who did some...
Oh, yes. Chris is a good friend of mine.
I wanted to ask you about that because I was reviewing his book on advanced machining, specifically the sculptures of Ramses II. And if we look at history, Ramses II is only a few thousand years ago, and yet the work that is revealed by Chris Dunn shows engineering to a level of machining. These sculptures are machined. So this is a technology.
Yeah, that's not the only example. Chris Dunn has provided, you know, hundreds of examples of that machine tool. It's one of the best ones.
It seems like an industry of these sculptures, these monstrous sculptures. What do you think about that?
Yeah, which frankly we couldn't do today. Some of the work is almost supernaturally good, and the precision is uncanny, and it cannot be explained with the simple stone tools that Egyptologists tell us were deployed to make it. It's just another one of those Egyptological fairy tales. We have a real problem with the cutting of stone. Chris Dunn, because he's an expert in this field, because he's a machine tool maker himself, speaks from, you know, from great depth of knowledge when he writes about this, and I'd like to pay tribute to Chris's work. And it's important to be clear, the ancient Egyptians saw themselves as the inheritors of a vastly ancient tradition. They saw their civilization as a legacy, not as a development. It had all been passed down to them from what they called the time of the gods, or Zeptepi, the first time. And there are strong indications in their texts as to when this first time was. And it falls again in that period around 12,000 years ago. So everything is pointing to something of great significance at that time. And the ancient Egyptians inherited this knowledge. In a sense, their culture was an attempt by the survivors of the lost civilization. It is the result of an attempt by the survivors of the lost civilization to reconstitute or to remake the former world of the gods. And it was a very long project in Egypt. And we see some of it happening around 12,000 years ago, and then it kind of disappears from the record, but the knowledge is clearly kept. I've often speculated that it may have been retained in something like a monastery, which was recruiting from the local population and initiating and passing down the wisdom and the knowledge and the skills from generation to generation to generation. And then for some reason, which we don't fully understand, they switch on Egyptian civilization, like switching on a light around 5,000 years ago. And it comes suddenly. And their very best work, again, in ancient Egypt is the oldest work. And often the work gets worse as time goes by. So whatever tools, whatever skills, whatever science was being deployed, the ancient Egyptians themselves saw it as inherited from a former time.
It's just amazing to see technology that we have no evidence of, and this is why it's so upsetting to people like Dunn when he's having Egyptologists who have no clue about the level of precision that he's talking about basically say that there was no machinery done. There's no
exactly. Exactly, because their preconceptions won't allow them to think about that. This is what holds science up, but it's part of human nature. We human beings can't perceive something without interpreting it, and inevitably we interpret it according to the system of ideas that we already hold. And this is a problem of perception, because it means that things that contradict our system of ideas actually are almost invisible. We can't see them. We're psychologically blocked from seeing them. And therefore, we need to open our minds to new possibilities, including the possibility of a lost civilization, if we're really to start to see the evidence that has been staring us in the face for so long. I mean, the Great Sphinx has been sitting out there in plain view for thousands of years. But it's only since 1992 that, you know, Robert Schock and John West came along and saw what nobody else had seen, that the weathering marks on it don't fit the story we're being told.
In the final few minutes that we have here, I have a personal question regarding consciousness. And in your other writings, you talk about levels of consciousness, DMT, and some of the shamanistic approaches to consciousness. I think, and I'm interested in your point of view, that the previous civilization looked at consciousness from a different perspective.
Oh, definitely.
I look at it from this point. I've studied and worked with Mayan shaman. I've interviewed and worked with and spoken in depth with Native American shaman and priests. And they have had this handed down, a point of view that nature has great deal of intelligence that needs to be accessed to live in harmony. Yes. And it seems to me that not only have we lost that connection, but the previous civilizations, and I'm seeing this more and more with the work of John Burke, who passed away, who studied telluric energy fields and natural geomagnetic.
Yeah, I knew John Burke. He was a great man.
Oh, he's a fantastic author.
Yeah.
But what I want to ask you is, doesn't it seem to you, or would you say that the previous civilization had more of a connection with the natural energetic flow of the earth and maybe utilized it in ways that we just don't understand?
The short answer to that is yes, absolutely, 100%. And the evidence for the use of visionary plants in ancient civilizations all around the world is extremely strong. I mean, our society today almost demonizes these visionary plants. and even makes their use illegal, thus criminalizing consciousness.
Yeah.
But ancient civilizations had a totally different view. You cannot find a great civilization of the ancient world which didn't make profound use of visionary plants and which held a deep connection to nature and which felt that intuitive and visionary experiences were at least as important as the kind of experiences we have in an alert, problem-solving state of consciousness. Just look at the modern attitude to dreaming, you know. In the modern world, if we call somebody a dreamer, we're insulting them. In the ancient world, if you called somebody a dreamer, you were praising them because dreams were seen as a valid path to knowledge.
Interesting. Okay, listen, thank you very much, Graham. I appreciate the time that we've spent here and much success on this new book.
Thank you.
I'm looking forward to reading it, and I think it's a worthy successor to your previous book, which was pretty groundbreaking. So
thank you. Thanks very much for having me on the show. And if anybody wants to follow up, go to my website, grahamhancock.com. There's loads of information there.
So that was Graham Hancock. I hope you enjoyed it. That was much shorter than I had hoped for. He is touring the United States right now, and the tour goes into the month of December. But I talked to him offline, and he will be coming back on the program probably in February to discuss specifics around Baalbek, Lebanon, that he discovered that are featured in the book. But there's been some other follow-ups, and perhaps the most important part of a follow-up with Graham would also be what has been discovered at in Indonesia with Dr. Danny Hillman at the Gunung Penang pyramid site. I might have mentioned last week that Bruce Cunningham and the Ancient Mysteries International tour are there right now, and we're hoping to have some interviews with Danny Hillman right on the site there with Bruce in the next couple of weeks. I'm trying to get some more confirmation on specific times, but we will definitely make it part of the future show, the next one or two shows that are coming up. That tour ends in about a week. So hope you enjoyed the program, and we'll talk to you next time.